Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I have never seen such destruction. We have seen many wars in films, but have never seen such destruction in any war. It is a mockery.
While Russian forces intensify their attacks in Ukraine, Russian President Putin defends the invasion on this V-Day in Russia, the day in 1945 when Russia, the Soviet Union, defeated the Nazis. Some U.S. lawmakers are openly calling the fighting in Ukraine a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia. We'll speak with Anatole Levin, who says giving Ukraine intel on Russian generals is a risky gamble. He argues Ukraine is already winning. Victory can be achieved without risking nuclear war. Then, in a major development in the ongoing attack on the lives of transgender people in the United States, Alabama's become the first state to make it a felony to provide gender-affirming medical care to trans youth. LGBTQ plus rights advocates say the law could deeply harm the mental health of trans youth, as a major survey shows they already face a high risk of suicide and depression. Then, an historic election in Northern Ireland.
Today ushers in a new era, which I believe presents us all with an opportunity to reimagine relationships in this society on the basis of fairness, on the basis of equality, and on the basis of social justice.
On Friday, the nationalist Sinn Féin Party won the most seats in Northern Ireland's parliament for the first time ever. Back to Northern Ireland, leaving the United Kingdom and reuniting with the Republic of Ireland. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major speech in Moscow's Red Square, Russian President Vladimir Putin has defended his invasion of Ukraine, saying it was needed to preemptively rebuff NATO. But Putin did not declare a broader war in Ukraine, as many in the West had predicted. Putin spoke earlier today as part of a Victory Day celebration to mark the Soviet Union's defeat of Nazi Germany in 1945.
Preparations were openly underway for another punitive operation in Donbas and an invasion of our historic lands, including Crimea. Kiev has announced a possible acquisition of nuclear weapons. The NATO bloc began active military development of the territories adjacent to ours. This was an absolutely unacceptable threat, systematically created for us and right on our borders. Russia has preemptively rebuffed the aggression. It was forced, timely, and the only right decision. The decision of a sovereign, strong, independent country.
President Putin spoke as some U.S. lawmakers are openly describing the fighting in Ukraine as a proxy war between the United States and Russia. This is Democratic Congressmember Seth Moulton, who serves on the House Armed Forces Committee, speaking on Fox News.
We're not just at war to support the Ukrainians. We're fundamentally at war, although somewhat through a proxy, with Russia, and it's important that we win.
In recent days, U.S. officials have leaked information alleging U.S. intelligence was used by Ukraine to kill Russian generals and to sink Russia's Moskva warship. The Pentagon's publicly acknowledged providing Ukraine what it calls battlefield intelligence, but it denies providing, quote, specific targeting information. President Biden's reportedly criticized the leak, saying they've been counterproductive. In other developments, up to 60 people are feared to have died after Russia shelled a school in Ukraine's Luhansk region, where scores of people were seeking shelter. In this besieged city of Mariupol, all women, children and elderly people have been evacuated from the steel plant, where they were holed up for 2 months. Fighting at the plant continues. This comes as the G7 has announced new sanctions on Russia, including a ban or phase out of Russian oil imports. Meanwhile, First Lady Jill Biden made a surprise trip on Mother's Day to Western Ukraine, where she met with Ukraine's First Lady, Olena Zelenska. It was the first time Zelenska was seen in public since the war began. Meanwhile, Canadian Premier Justin Trudeau made a surprise visit to Kyiv on Sunday. In Northern Ireland, the nationalist Sinn Féin party has won the most seats in Northern Ireland's parliament for the first time. Sinn Féin is the former political wing of the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, which for decades fought against British rule of Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin's vice president, Michelle O'Neill, appears poised to become the first Catholic to lead Northern Ireland. O'Neill is a supporter of plans to reunify Northern Ireland with the Republic of Ireland.
Those of us that are for unification will make that case. I encourage those that actually don't have that perspective at this moment in time to also enter into the conversation. Let's have a healthy debate about what our future looks like, something that's better for each and every one of us, where we all have a valued place in our society.
We'll have more on the elections in Northern Ireland later in the program. Voters in the Philippines headed to the polls today for a closely watched presidential election. Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the son of the late Filipino dictator, is expected to win the 10-way presidential race. His chief rival is Leni Robredo, the country's current vice president. Under the Philippines Constitution, President Rodrigo Duterte could not seek a second term. Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has spent decades defending his father's brutal rule, which saw 34,000 people tortured and over 3,200 murdered between 1965 and 1986. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll speak with the Filipino Nobel Prize-winning journalist Maria Ressa. In Afghanistan, the Taliban's issued a new dress code for women, ordering them to cover their faces in public. Repeated violations of the new decree could result in a woman's father or closest male relative being jailed for 3 days. The United Nations mission to Afghanistan criticized the decree, saying, quote, "This decision contradicts numerous assurances regarding respect for and protection of all Afghans' human rights." Hong Kong's former security chief, John Lee, has been formally picked to head the city after Chief Executive Carrie Lam's term ends next month. Lee's election is expected to further solidify China's control over Hong Kong. On Sunday, he received 99% of the vote from Hong Kong's election committee. He was the only candidate in running. As Hong Kong's security chief, Lee oversaw the crackdown on protesters who were demanding more autonomy from Beijing. Sri Lanka's prime minister has resigned, clearing the way for the formation of a new cabinet as Sri Lanka looks for ways to end a devastating economic crisis. Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa, as the brother of the president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who's faced charges of nepotism and corruption since he installed three siblings into high-level government posts. Large anti-government protests in recent weeks have demanded the ouster of all members of the Rajapaksa family. Earlier today, supporters of the ruling party stormed a major protest site in the capital, Colombo, attacking protesters and prompting clashes with police who fired tear gas and water cannons. Dozens were injured. Authorities have ordered a nationwide curfew across Sri Lanka. A refugee aid group says at least 44 people drowned off the coast of the Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara on Sunday after their boat capsized as they attempted to reach the Canary Islands to request asylum in Spain. 12 others were arrested by Moroccan authorities after they survived the ordeal. Spain's Interior Ministry reports more than 40,000 migrants arrived in Spain by sea in 2021. Morocco says it stopped more than 63,000 crossings last year. back in the United States, protests are continuing across the country to defend reproductive rights following last week's publication of a leaked Supreme Court draft opinion showing the court's poised to overturn Roe v. Wade. Over the weekend, demonstrators gathered outside the homes of Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh. This comes as a new CNN poll released Friday shows two-thirds of the country opposes overturning Roe v. Wade. Meanwhile, authorities in Madison, Wisconsin are investigating a fire at the headquarters of an anti-choice group called Wisconsin Family Action. No one was injured in the blaze. A message was spray-painted on the building's exterior reading, quote, "If abortions aren't safe, then you aren't either." The Biden administration's warning a new wave of COVID-19 could infect 100 million people in the United States this fall and winter. The White House issued the warning as it called on Congress to approve $22.5 billion in new pandemic funding. Dr. Ashish Jha, now the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, spoke to ABC.
We're looking at a range of models, both internal and external models. And what they're predicting is that if we don't get ahead of this thing, we're going to have a lot of waning immunity. This virus continues to evolve. And we may see a pretty sizable wave of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths this fall and winter.
President Biden's declared a major disaster in New Mexico, where strong winds and continuing drought conditions have helped the Calf Canyon fire grow to become the second largest fire in New Mexico's recorded history. The fire began burning over a month ago and is still less than 50% contained. It scorched more than 275 square miles, an area larger than the city of Chicago. It's one of six major fires currently burning in New Mexico. In Havana, Cuba, at least 31 people died and 54 people were injured Friday after a massive explosion at a luxury hotel. The blast is believed to have been caused by a gas leak at the Saratoga Hotel, which was closed at the time for renovations. The explosion also damaged nearby buildings, including the historic Martí Theater. On Sunday, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel held talks in Havana with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO, who was wrapping up a five-country tour. AMLO criticized the Biden administration over reports the U.S. will exclude Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela from next month's Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles.
Insistiré.
I will insist to President Biden that no country in the Americas be excluded from next month's summit to be held in Los Angeles, California, and that the authorities of each country should freely decide whether or not to attend said meeting, but nobody should exclude anyone.
To see our interview with Cuba's deputy foreign minister, go to democracynow.org. During an earlier stop in Guatemala, the Mexican president criticized the United States for sending tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine instead of fulfilling pledges to help Latin American nations address the root causes of migration.
There are many different things that we should not compare, but more than $30 billion have already been approved to support the war in Ukraine, and we have spent 4 years since President Donald Trump was proposing support with $4 billion to Central America, and to this day, there has been nothing.
And in other news from Mexico, a longtime journalist has been found dead in Sinaloa State. Luis Enrique Ramirez was a columnist at El Debate. He's the ninth Mexican journalist killed this year and the 34th to be killed since Andrés Manuel López Obrador took office in 2018. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major speech in Moscow's Red Square today, Russian President Vladimir Putin defended his invasion of Ukraine, saying it was needed to preemptively rebuff NATO. Putin spoke at a military parade to mark the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in 1945 during World War II.
Preparations were openly underway for another punitive operation in Donbas and an invasion of our historic lands, including Crimea. Kiev has announced a possible acquisition of nuclear weapons. The NATO bloc began active military development of the territories adjacent to ours. This was an absolutely unacceptable threat, systematically created for us and right on our borders. Russia has preemptively rebuffed the aggression. It was forced, timely, and the only right decision. The decision of a sovereign, strong, independent country.
In his speech, Putin directly addressed Russian soldiers fighting in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine, which Russia has pledged to liberate from Kiev's control, and he paused for a minute of silence for fallen Russian fighters. But Putin did not actually mention Ukraine by name, and he did not declare a broader war in Ukraine, as some had predicted. He spoke as some lawmakers, U.S. lawmakers, are openly describing the fighting in Ukraine as a proxy war between the United States and Russia. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, the United States, and the Group of Seven leaders announced a new round of sanctions against Russia Sunday, including a ban or phase-out of Russia oil imports. Also on Sunday, U.S. First Lady Jill Biden made an unannounced Mother's Day trip into Ukraine, where she visited a school and met with the First Lady of Ukraine, who appeared in public for the first time since Russia's invasion. For more, we're joined by Anatole Levin, senior fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, where his latest piece is headlined, "Giving Ukraine Intel on Russian Generals is a Risky Gamble." He's author of a number of books on Russia and the former Soviet republics, including Ukraine and Russia. His recent piece in The Guardian is headlined, "Ukraine is already winning. Victory can be achieved without risking nuclear war." Well, thanks so much for joining us again, Anatole Levin. I wanted to ask you about V-Day today in Russia. So many pundits in the West predicted that President Putin would declare war on Ukraine today. This is V-Day, Victory Day, when the Soviet Union in 1945 declared victory over the Nazis. But the fact is, while he did blame the West for not agreeing to security issues in December, while he did talk about the what's happening in Ukraine as a clash with neo-Nazis, and he did say Donbas fighters are on their own land, what Putin did not do was declare war on Ukraine. And he addressed the issue of the loss of Russian soldiers. If you could comment on this and then talk about your latest piece where you say that U.S. providing intel that ultimately led to the killing of Russian soldiers, as well as the killing of Russian generals, as well as the sinking of the Moskva battleship in the Black Sea, is a mistake.
Yes. Well, I mean, as to the Victory Day parade and Putin's the fact that he didn't declare general mobilization in Russia for war, I think this indicates that they are going to go for a long, long campaign of trying to grind down the Ukrainian army in the east, and so as to take the whole of the Donbas region. I mean, what they will do after that is not clear. Their casualties have been so enormous that at some point they may offer a ceasefire and negotiations. And Ukraine has also proposed negotiations. On the killing of the generals, it was well known in private that American intelligence was being very helpful to the Ukrainians in their defense. It does seem to me, though, that actually deliberately killing Russian senior officers is a pretty provocative step, which during the Cold War, neither side would have contemplated doing because of the risk of escalation. And if, as has been the case so far, and if one presumes it continues, US and NATO arms supplies to Ukraine continue to play a critical role in Ukrainian military successes, then there is an obvious risk that Russia will try to terrify the West, particularly the Europeans, of course, into supporting a Russian peace on Russian terms by some form of drastic escalation. Now, also contrary to some analysis, Putin did not declare anything of this kind today. So clearly Russia has not made up its mind to this. But, of course, the worse Russia does in Ukraine and the longer the war lasts, the greater the temptation will be for Russia to escalate so as basically to frighten off Western support for Ukraine.
And the significance also of the U.S. actually admitting it provided intelligence, for example, on battleship Moskva, which is the flagship in the Black Sea, sinking. But apparently behind the scenes, furious that the leak was made that says the U.S. provided the intel. And again, in both cases, saying they did not provide the intel for the ship to be sunk or the generals to be assassinated.
Yes, well, Bill Burns, the head of the CIA, has very strongly criticized the leaks and tried to row back on them. But certainly people I know who are knowledgeable in this field believe that the leaks were actually, you know, accurate. And indeed, I mean, you know, if the U.S. is giving real-time intelligence to Ukraine about Russian targets, then, you know, this is very much what one would have predicted. But as I say, targeting senior officers is a step further than that. And once again, I mean, it goes beyond the traditional CIA playbook and the KGB playbook, which was that you don't target commanders on either side because that does risk drastic escalation.
Yesterday, on May 8th, President Zelensky in Ukraine compared Russia's actions in Ukraine to those of Nazi Germany, saying the evil has been reborn. And again today, Putin referred once again to what's happening in Ukraine. The invasion is to fight neo-Nazis.
Oh, everybody is doing this now on both sides. You know, this is war propaganda. And of course, the use of the term genocide by both sides and the United States has, you know, has become completely ridiculous, frankly. Genocide is now being used as a synonym for, you know, any killing or even mild oppression of civilians. I have to say that for me as a historian, this, you know, is deeply insulting to victims of true genocides like the Nazi Holocaust or the Rwandan genocide. It's just a piece of sloppy and either stupid or cynical propaganda on all sides.
And do you think the fact that really Putin's speech was very muted today, again, did not talk about this as a war and did not refer to it as he has as a special security operation, that he is really dealing with the blows of Ukraine, extremely armed by the West, fighting back, even taking back towns that the Russians had occupied in the last weeks?
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, you know, Putin has got Russia into the most terrible mess in Ukraine. You know, so far, Russia has not fully achieved any of its key objectives. And its main one, its initial one, to overthrow the Ukrainian government and subordinate the whole of Ukraine to Russia, has failed completely. So now they're trying for a much more limited success in the East, but they're making only the, you know, slowest of progress on the ground, even towards that. Now, the Putin propaganda and state machine has managed so far to, you know, to rally a majority of the Russian people behind the government and the campaign. But if this war goes on, and Russian casualties mount and mount, and there is quite obviously, you know, no Russian victory, then the future of the Putin regime must be in serious doubt sooner or later. And undoubtedly, I mean, public discontent must grow, though how quickly, who can say?
I wanted to go to Democratic Congressmember Seth Moulton, who serves on the House Armed Services Committee, the Armed Forces Committee, who has joined a number of U.S. lawmakers in openly describing the fighting in Ukraine as a proxy war between the United States and Russia. This is what he said on Fox.
We're not just at war to support the Ukrainians. We're fundamentally at war, although it's somewhat through a proxy, with Russia, and it's important that we win.
Your response, Anatole Levin.
Well, all I can say is that Representative Moulton ought to be working for Vladimir Putin, because this kind of thing, you know, is just wonderful for Putin's propaganda, partly because he can tell the Russian people, oh, you know, it's not Ukraine that is fighting us to a standstill. You know, we are fighting against the whole of NATO and the United States. That makes Russian defeats much easier to excuse, of course, and accept. And it really mobilizes Russian nationalism behind the campaign. But also, I think it's profoundly stupid as a strategy, because it implies that the US is at war, which it isn't. I mean, you know, it's providing weapons and intelligence, and that there are U.S. goals in this war which go, you know, beyond Ukraine and Ukrainian goals. Because as President Zelensky has said again and again, you know, this war has to end in some kind of peace agreement and compromise. But people in America, like Moulton, seem to be aiming more and more for complete victory over Russia. Well, of course, defeating Russia and driving it out completely is a very different matter from fighting Russia to a standstill. I mean, that is a recipe for this war going on, you know, essentially forever, with colossal suffering for Ukraine. But also, of course, as I say, the risk that sooner or later Russia will lose its temper and escalate in some way, by way of trying to frighten the West. So for me, this is an extremely risky strategy, and also a very stupid thing to say.
Finally, your warning to the West right now.
Well, I should say that I completely agree with Western support to Ukraine and also sanctions against Russia. But the question is, you know, what is the goal of this? Is the goal of this peace and Russian withdrawal, which must be based on some kind of territorial compromise over Crimea and at least part of the Donbass, is that what our pressure on Russia and support for Ukraine is aiming at? Or do we have a much, much greater and much more dangerous goal? I don't think Western governments are at all clear about this. I think they're divided. And I think we really need to achieve clarity on this critical point.
Anatole Levin, I want to thank you for being with us, senior fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of Ukraine and Russia. His latest piece, headlined "Giving Ukraine Intel on Russian Generals is a Risky Gamble." His recent piece in The Guardian, "Ukraine is Already Winning. Victory Can Be Achieved Without Risking Nuclear War." We'll link to it at all at democracynow.org. Next up, major development in the ongoing attacks on the lives of trans people here in the United States. Alabama's become the first state to make it a felony to provide gender-affirming medical care to trans youth. We'll turn to Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Trans Justice with the ACLU. Stay with us.
From you, red magic satin playing near two. All through the morning rain, I gave the sun doesn't shine. Rainbows and waterfalls run through my mind. In the garden, I see west purple shower bells, orange birds and river cousins.
Strawberry Letter 23 by the Brothers Johnson. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major development in the ongoing attacks on the lives of transgender people in the United States, Alabama has become the first state in the nation to make it a felony to provide gender-affirming medical care to trans youth. A law went into effect Sunday that bans the use of puberty blockers and hormones, which can be life-saving for trans children and teens. Doctors and others who are found in violation of the law could face up to 10 years in prison in Alabama. The measure is taking effect even as it's being challenged by the Human Rights Campaign and other LGBTQ plus rights groups. The Justice Department has also joined the case, saying the Alabama law violates constitutional rights. A similar measure in Arkansas has been blocked by a federal judge. This comes after Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida introduced a bill Friday that would prohibit employers from deducting expenses related to their workers' travel costs when seeking gender-affirming care for their children out of state, as well as for those seeking an abortion. LGBTQ plus rights advocates say these laws are violent and discriminatory and deeply harm the mental health of trans youth as they already face a high risk of depression and suicide. A new survey by the Trevor Project found 45% of LGBTQ plus youth in the U.S. have seriously considered attempting suicide in the past year. Trans youth and LGBTQ plus youth of color reported the greatest suicide risk. At least 60% of the youth surveyed said they wanted mental health care in the past year, but were not able to get it. For more, we're joined here in New York by Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Trans Justice with the ACLU LGBTQ and HIV Project. Chase, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of yesterday, the first law in the country that has been enacted, this one in Alabama, against trans youth.
Thanks, Amy, and good morning. I mean, this is just a really devastating and terrifying time on so many levels. And with Alabama's law, this is a law that's been introduced in Alabama since 2020. We've been able to block it in 2020 and 2021. They continued to move it forward. Unfortunately, on the last day of the legislative session, it was pushed through. It was immediately signed by the governor. It had an emergency effective date, which meant there was only 30 days from the time it was signed by Governor Ivey in Alabama to when it went into effect, creating an absolute terrifying sea change in the reality on the ground for trans people, their families, and their doctors in Alabama, and not just in Alabama, but across the Southeast. The University of Alabama has a gender clinic that is serving trans adolescents and their families, not just in Alabama, but in Georgia and Florida and Tennessee and Mississippi. And now, in a matter of hours, all of that care is becoming a felony, which means families are uprooting their lives. They're trying to figure out when and whether they can get life-saving care for their adolescent children. And I think it's important to note that this is all happening in the same context that we're seeing the criminalization of abortion care, that we're continuing to see the massive suppression of votes across the country. And all of these things are interconnected and creating chaos and fear among individuals, families, and communities across 50% of the country, at least, because we are looking at a situation where come June, we're going to have an absolute sea change in the realities of our federal constitutional rights, which is going to lead to actions by the states that are going to continue this type of escalation that we're seeing in Alabama and elsewhere.
Chase, let's talk more about the content of this Alabama law and other similar laws, such as the executive directive that was issued by the Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott, which orders the Department of Family and Protective Services in that state to conduct child abuse investigations into parents who give gender-affirming care to their trans children. The Texas directive is now on hold. A major new report published last week by the Yale Law School, the Yale School of Medicine, and the University of Texas Southwestern notes, quote, Texas and Alabama officials have falsely claimed that doctors are routinely sterilizing children and teenagers with surgical procedures. It also says both states, quote, consistently ignore the mainstream scientific evidence that documents the substantial benefits of gender-affirming care, greatly exaggerate the risks of gender-affirming drug therapy, and rely on poor quality evidence, unquote. One of the co-authors of the report, Meredith McNamara of the Yale School of Medicine and Child Study Center, said, quote, we need to call for fact-based based checks on legal opinions and legislation. Scientists need to have a seat at the table. And perhaps most importantly, there must be a penalty for writing fake science into law. Trans and non-binary youth are facing the fight of their lives to simply exist, and we can't let them stand alone. This is a matter of life and death, she said. Chase, your response, and talk about the significance of this Yale Medical School report.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. This is so important that we have accountability, that we have fact check. And it is true that these laws are codifying complete misinformation and outright lies about this care. Young people are not being forcibly sterilized when it comes to gender-affirming care. They are being forcibly sterilized in many circumstances when it comes to the non-consensual surgeries on intersex infants that are explicitly allowed under these laws. But we have to be clear about what's happening. And it's not just Republican lawmakers that are codifying this misinformation. The public discourse, the media is all complicit in this because we have spent the last 5 years and more having a debate, a so-called debate over the legitimacy of trans life that has allowed these types of laws to flourish. And the reality is that this care is safe. This care is effective. You have 21 medical groups weighing in court in Texas, in Alabama, saying these laws must be enjoined. This is safe medical care that we have used for decades. This is effective medical care that we know to save the lives of adolescents. And by the way, this care is only provided to adolescents. They talk about children, but this is treatment that is provided to people once they have reached puberty. It is already incredibly difficult to access. There are long waiting lines. There are long waitlist. It can be cost prohibitive already for many families. And the reality is that there are conservative protocols in place that govern the provision of this care through very strictly regulated medical protocols. We're talking about a situation where parents are consenting, adolescents are consenting, and the doctors are recommending this treatment. And it is treatment that is well studied, it is well provided, and it has documented benefits for these young people. But instead of recognizing that, we're in a situation with the escalated criminalization of this care. In the case of Texas, we have the governor directing the Department of Protective Service to investigate families. Thankfully, that is on hold. And then we have Alabama that is now criminalizing this care in the context of the provision of the care by parents and doctors up to the age of 19. And as we're talking about the ages here, I think it's really important to note that Republican legislatures across the country continue to creep the age later and later. So we hear the discourse of children, but Missouri, for example, has proposed legislation that would block this care up to age 25. The reality is that it's not about protecting children. It's not about protecting anyone. It's about surveilling and criminalizing trans bodies and making this medical care increasingly out of reach because we're continuing to see the propagation of this misinformation about what this care actually is.
Chase, let me ask you about the Florida middle school teacher who says she was fired from her job in March for discussing sexuality with her students. Casey Scott, an art teacher at Trafalgar Middle School in Lee County, says her students began asking questions about her sexual orientation. She shared with them she's pansexual. Her students were then inspired to create art that expressed their own sexual orientation and gender identity. Scott hung their artwork in the classroom. She says she was then told by Lee County School District officials to remove the artwork, was sent home, and fired over the phone. In a statement to NBC News, the Lee County School District said Scott was fired because she, quote, did not follow the state-mandated curriculum. See, Florida recently enacted the new law known as the Don't Say Gay Bill, which prohibits discussion on sexual orientation and gender identity in the classroom of younger kids up to third grade. The measure expected to go into effect July 1st. Say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a situation now where across the country, we have these so-called restrictions on any discussion of sexual orientation or gender identity. Of course, everyone has a sexual orientation. Everyone has a gender identity. They're not prohibiting people from talking about boys and girls. They're not prohibiting heterosexual teachers from talking about their spouses. These are laws that are aimed and targeted very explicitly at the LGBT community. And we're starting to see the fallout from that. It means that people can't talk about their families in the classroom. It means that kids can't share their own experience of existence or the existence of their families. And it's not just in Florida. Florida's bill got a lot of press attention, but Oklahoma passed a similar bill. Alabama passed a bill on the final day of session, along with the felony health ban. We're going to see these types of escalations happening across the country. And the reality is that the goal of these pieces of legislation are to expand the power of the state to constrain what we can and cannot talk about, to constrain who we can and cannot be, to constrain the possibilities for our lives. And we're starting to see it with the control over teachers, over this so-called curricular regulation. But the reality is that this is a constraint on people being able to share their histories. And the more we constrain the ability to tell the truth about the histories that we've all known to be true when we're in communities whose histories have been systematically erased, is that it leaves more space for the government to escalate the type of criminalization that we're seeing. For example, this type of constraint on discussion of LGBTQ people is not new. It's reemergent. Alabama, until very recently, had a law that officially had forced teachers to include in the curriculum of the state to express that homosexuality was against the moral fiber of the people of Alabama. We have a long history in this country of criminalizing cross-dressing laws, and we're seeing all of these things reemerge at the same time that the government is enforcing these imperatives to erase those histories so that we can act like these are new things, that they are not part of the centuries-long histories that are designed to expand the power of the state and to constrain people's survival opportunities. These are not isolated incidents. They are part of a coordinated attack, and we should be very concerned because right now it's 2022. We're facing the midterms. We're facing the 2024 presidential election, and these are all very strategic efforts to mobilize voters to make it harder and harder for people to build a check on governmental power.
Finally, Chase, I wanted to talk to you about this historic week around abortion, the leaked draft opinion that the Supreme Court's going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I want to talk about both abortion and gender-affirming care. We reported earlier that Florida's Republican Senator Marco Rubio introduced a bill Friday that would prohibit employers from deducting expenses related to their employees' travel costs when seeking gender-affirming care for their children out of state, as well as for those seeking an abortion. So if you can talk about what often in this last week hasn't been talked about as much because, the abortion issue has been preeminent, why it's important to talk about trans care at the same time. And if you can also talk about inclusive language around pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at the reality of how specifically the right has systematically over the last 50 years used state legislatures and the federal judiciary to slowly expand the power of the state to control people's reproductive choices and erode the federal constitutional right to access abortion, that very playbook is being utilized to constrain much more than access to abortion. It's being used to constrain access to contraception. It's being used to constrain access to the restroom if you're a trans person. It's being used to constrain access to healthcare for transgender adolescents. And the reality is that the animating goal behind all of these pieces of legislation is to control people's bodies, to enforce codes and norms of gender and sexuality that entrench power in the hands of the state, that enforce a heterosexual Christian nuclear family as the only model that is part of a state building project, by the way. And so if we don't connect these things, we are ultimately going to see the erosion of all of our rights. If you look at something like SB 8 in Texas, which went into effect months ago, that type of legislation that creates a bounty provision where private citizens are deputized by the government to surveil and criminalize and enforce criminal penalties against their neighbors, that is exactly what's happening to trans young people and their families in Texas and elsewhere. And then you look at the expansion of these criminal penalties in proposed legislation where we're starting to see efforts to criminalize people for going out of state to access the healthcare that they need in the abortion context, in the trans context. These are part and parcel of the very same playbook. The same lawmakers that are introducing the anti-abortion legislation are introducing the anti-trans bills in the same committees, in the same states. It is all part of the same strategy to enforce norms of gender, enforce norms of sexuality that limit people's reproductive autonomy and ability to self-determine their identities. And the reality is that we have failed to mobilize collectively, and we have let the right divide us, which has been very effective for them and very unfortunate for us, because we're looking at a situation now where we are going to see a Supreme Court that is ready and willing to erode not just the constitutional right to access abortion, but the right to access contraception, the right to access marriage equality, the right to determine whether and how we can access health care generally when that health care is about affirming who we are. So we should have a lot of questions for ourselves in these movements about how we're going to fight back collectively and not rely on the discourse that the state is setting forth that is set up to divide us. And when it comes to language and sort of the distraction of inclusive language in the public conversation. You can see you have this opinion leaked early in the week, last week, where this is devastating for the future of so many people's ability to survive and access safe medical care. And then you have some people focusing on the fact that on occasion we recognize that some people who are not women become pregnant. We may use the language of pregnant people. We may use the language of birthing people. That is just a fact. And the reality is women are people, by the way. And people may become pregnant who are not women. That we acknowledge reality on occasion to, hold space for people like me who are not women who may become pregnant. That's just a factual truth. It allows people to have more access to care. It allows a more robust movement that lets more people in, which is always to the benefit of everyone. But we're not out here saying that we shouldn't talk about women. People can still talk about women. These laws target women. There is an important conversation to be had about the systematic attack on women's opportunities, on the regulation of women's bodies. The reality is such, though, that it's not just women who are affected. And by the way, the more we have this non-inclusive discourse, it's not just trans men and non-binary people who are excluded. It's the entire system of gender-based policing that is then invisibilized, because this harms all of us, and we all have a role to play in fighting back.
Chase Stranger, I want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Director for the Trans Justice with the ACLU, LGBTQ, and HIV Project. Next up, an historic election in Northern Ireland, where the nationalist Sinn Féin Party has won the most seats in Northern Ireland's parliament for the first time in history. Back in 30 seconds.
I am a proud young Irishman. In Ulster's hills my life began, a happy boy through green fields ran. I kept God's and man's laws, but when my age was barely 10, my country's wrongs were told.
H Block by Anne and Francis Brawley. H Block was shorthand for the Mays Prison, where within whose H-shaped blocks the 1981 Irish Republican hunger striker took place. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the historic election in Northern Ireland in the United Kingdom, where on Friday the nationalist Sinn Féin Party won the most seats in Northern Ireland's parliament for the first time ever. Sinn Féin is the former political wing of the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, which for decades fought against British rule. Sinn Féin's vice president, Michelle O'Neill, appears poised to become the first Catholic to lead Northern Ireland. O'Neill backs Northern Ireland leaving the United Kingdom and reuniting with the Republic of Ireland.
Those of us that are for unification will make that case. I encourage those that actually don't have that perspective at this moment in time to also enter into the conversation. Let's have a healthy debate about what our future looks like, something that's better for each and every one of us, where we all have a valued place in our society.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Derry, Northern Ireland, Eamon McCann is with us, a journalist, writer, activist, and former member of the Northern Ireland Assembly. 50 years ago, he took part in the march on Bloody Sunday in 1972, helped form the Bloody Sunday Trust. He's the author of the recently republished 1974 book, War and an Irish Town. Also with us, Mairead Farrell, a Sinn Féin lawmaker in the Irish Parliament. She's joining us from Galway City in the Republic of Ireland. She is the niece of Mairead Farrell, who was a member of the Provisional Irish Republican Army, shot dead by the British Army in Gibraltar in 1988. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mairead Farrell, I want to turn to you first. If you can explain to a global audience the significance of what has taken place and the fact, interestingly, that it is women-led.
Absolutely. And I think what's quite interesting and significant as well about the Sinn Féin MLAs, so those are those members of the Assembly, is that 55% of them actually are indeed women. And of course, we are led by Michelle O'Neill, who is set to become the First Minister in the Executive and in the Assembly. And I think, look, I suppose I think it can't be understated, in fact, the significance of the fact that Michelle O'Neill is set to become the First Minister. And I think it's very reflective of a very positive campaign that Sinn Féin led in this election campaign, indeed, in relation to the key issues of the day. Those key issues of the day, as we know, are issues that are affecting people across across the world, and indeed the rising cost of living. But and I think my own party president put it quite well at the weekend, to really show people the significance of the fact that Michelle O'Neill is poised to become First Minister, is the fact that Mary Lou McDonald said that the reality is that that state was created in order for a Michelle O'Neill, so someone like Michelle O'Neill, a woman from the nationalist community, to never become First Minister. So I think the fact that we are the largest party and that Michelle O'Neill has received that mandate is hugely, hugely significant. And I think it's something that just simply cannot be underestimated. It's a really big day. She's in Stormont today. It's lunchtime here in Ireland, and she's in, Michelle O'Neill's in Stormont. She's there with the team. There's the 27 MLAs. This is the Assembly in the North. So Stormont, the Assembly in the North, that she's there today to lead the Sinn Féin team of 27 MLAs. So those members of the Assembly, and to create that Assembly and to create that Executive.
And can you talk about Mary Lou McDonald?
Absolutely. I could talk about Mary Lou McDonald all day if you wanted me to. But Mary Lou McDonald is the president of Sinn Féin. So Michelle O'Neill is the leader in the North, and she's our vice president. So she leads us in the Assembly. And then Mary Lou McDonald leads us in the Dáil, which is the parliament in which I sit. And she is the Sinn Féin president. So she is the leader of the opposition at this very moment in time. And she's been excellent in keeping the government to, holding the government to account on the very key issues of the day. And again, those key issues are the key issues, as we know, that are affecting working people across the world. And those are the rising costs of living, the fact that, you know, we're seeing huge increases in the cost of living while we're not seeing the same increases, of course, in the pay that comes in the door. And indeed, that the supports that are there, that are needed for people, simply aren't there. So Mary Lou McDonald is our president, and she's leading us from the front, and she's been absolutely excellent over the last number of days in leading this party. But today, of course, the focus is on Michelle O'Neill. Michelle O'Neill, who is going into the Assembly, who's ready to set up the Executive to have Stormont back up and running. And I'm looking forward to Michelle O'Neill being First Minister.
And your thoughts, Damien Reid Farrell, about how your aunt would feel, who was killed by the British Army, an IRA member for whom you're named?
Well, I suppose for me, I never met my aunt, so I don't like to, speak to for people that I don't know. But look, I think that she was killed before I was born, so 2 years before I was born. But of course, I mean, for people who have campaigned all their lives, and indeed she campaigned all her life. Indeed, I'm now older than she ever got to be, because she was killed by the SAS. But she never had that opportunity. But look, she had campaigned all her life for Irish freedom, and indeed for a far more equitable Ireland than what we have at this very moment in time. And of course, it's a significant step. It's a huge step forward to see Michelle O'Neill, to see Sinn Féin as the largest party, to see Michelle O'Neill ready and willing to form that executive and to deal with the key issues of the day. And I think that's very important, because what we're hearing now is that, you know, that the DUP have said that, you know, they want certain issues with regard to the protocol dealt with before forming an executive. But the reality is that the people who are suffering as a result of the executive not forming are those people that are suffering as a result of the cost of living crisis, that are suffering because there's huge waiting lists in the health system. There's a budget that's ready there to go, and indeed my colleague Conor Murphy, who was finance minister, had a budget ready to go of $1 billion over 3 years for the health service. That's what needs to be delivered now. That's what the focus needs to be on this week, when Michelle O'Neill takes takes up the position of First Minister. And what we need is everyone to come around the table and to deal with those very key, very relevant issues for people.
Eamon McCann, you're joining us from Derry in Northern Ireland. Speaking of history, you're a former member of the Northern Ireland Assembly. You took part in the Bloody Sunday March of 1972, helped form the Bloody Sunday Trust. If you can talk about the significance of what we're seeing today, and again, speak to a global audience who is not that familiar with the politics of Ireland.
Well, Northern Ireland was founded 101 years ago. And many historians would agree that it was founded in order, insofar as it could be guaranteed, that there would always be a unionist majority. That is to say, a majority of people who wanted to maintain the link with Britain, who wanted Northern Ireland to be British. Now, the state was founded in order to give that section of the population a permanent majority. Well, permanence has lasted a century, and I suppose that's not too bad. But it's gone now. It's gone now. There can be no guarantee. It can't be given by the British government or anyone else that Northern Ireland is going to remain part of the United Kingdom. And the prospect emerges of Sinn Féin is already the largest party in the north, as has just been mentioned. It is also almost certain to become the largest party in Southern Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, when the next elections come along there in 2 years' time. Now, that would mean that the First Minister in Northern Ireland, the Taoiseach First Minister in the Republic of Ireland, were both from the Sinn Féin party and both from a party that is committed to Irish unity. And that's going to create a very interesting situation in the north, because that, if you like, very clearly foreshadows or prefigures a united Ireland, and because that alarms unionists in the north to the same extent as it pleases nationalists in the north. Which is not to say, and Ireland's a complicated place, as you know, as the more the tide towards the United Ireland increases, the more alarmed the unionists will become. And connected to that is the fact that there has emerged in the last election, and this too is historic, there has emerged a centre ground, if you like, represented by the Alliance Party, which radicals like myself would regard as a conservative, a middle-class party. Nevertheless, it is neither orange nor green. It is not unionist or nationalist. And you have got to now, you know, a significant section of the representatives in Stormont who do not designate themselves orange or green, nationalist or unionist or nationalist. And that's a new factor. And the reason, if I could just finish on this, that it's a new factor, is that the constitution in Northern Ireland, the arrangement set up under the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, doesn't allow for three separate designations at Stormont. I mean, it is built upon the Good Friday Agreement, is built upon the notion, really, the implicit notion, that everybody in Northern Ireland can be allocated to either the Green Party or the Orange Party. And then the task is, and this is what the Good Friday Agreement was about, to find a way in which the Green side and the Orange side can live together and share power. The implications of another bloc in the middle, neither orange nor green, emerging, and I think that really is in the process of emerging, they are uncharted. This was never planned for. And so it's going to be interesting to watch that, and none of us knows how it's going to work out.
I also wanted to go to former President of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, leading a vigil last week in West Belfast, marking the 41st year since the death of Bobby Sands, May 5th, 1981, while on hunger strike at the Mays prison.
Very impressive white line picket to mark the anniversary of the death of Bobby Sands 41 years ago. So those of us who were active in those days will remember with sadness and huge pride Bobby and the other hunger strikers.
And that's former Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams standing with others, leading a vigil, holding Bobby Sands' picture. How Bobby Sands' death and the hunger strikes and the IRA link to the victory today for Sinn Féin, Eamon?
Yes, well, it's And it's a long time since Bobby Sands died, of course. And Bobby Sands died in pursuit of a united Ireland. He gave his life literally, I mean, to bring about a united Ireland. And there can be a discussion today in 2022, and indeed there is a discussion, as to whether the settlement which has been reached under the Good Friday Agreement, whether that represents an adequate return on the pain sort of invested, if you like, by Republicans and by the nationalist community generally in Northern Ireland. Is the settlement which is now being put in place and which is operating, is that a fair enough return? And that's a question, of course, which we can't answer yes or no, or certainly we can't answer it yes or no as yet. So again, sort of there's, when we talk about, there's a very fluid situation in Ireland, and particularly in Northern Ireland, and it would be foolish to analyse it in terms of, you know, static positions for and against unification or for and against retaining Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom. In the cliche,
we have 5 seconds, Eamon.
Okay, Alicia, it's still all to be played for. Whether we get a final settlement, that was very dubious. Northern Ireland defies logic. And so nobody knows. Literally, I don't know. Nobody else knows how this thing is going to work out.
We'll leave it there, Eamon McCann, journalist, 1974 book just republished, War in an Irish Town. May read Farrell, Sinn Féin lawmaker in the Irish Parliament. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.